Hi, so welcome to Better Off Read, and this week I spoke with Helen Rickaby about Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Helen Rickaby is an amazing poet. She's also an incredible publisher. She publishes under Seraph Press, which I'll put a link up for. I got to hang out with Helen twice this week, which was great. The first night we were having a party, well, a sort of crafting exciting circle where we hand-bound Nina Powell's new book of poetry, which I'll also put a link up to, which Helen has just published. It's a beautiful little book of poetry. So yeah, we talked about Frankenstein, and then we wandered. Like I said, Helen has so many strings to her bow that we couldn't just stay in one spot. So yeah, that's there for you to listen to. On the table was also a pop-up book of Frankenstein, which I've put some photos on the website of. Anyway, thank you so much. See you soon. Okay, so we are here. I've walked up the hill and I'm at Helen Rickaby's beautiful house, and we're looking out on the harbour. It feels quite romantic, capital R romantic. It's very big and awe-inspiring up here. And we're going to talk about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein today. And yeah, we're both holding a copy. I've got the Oxford World Classic and you've got a Claremont Classics. My one is from... Oh, what's that?
I think it's one of those, like, a Wordsworth Classics. It's really nice. Lame ones with no notes.
No notes! Oh. Yeah. My one comes from... This is the book I bought when I was at Otago University and doing capital R romantic literature with a teacher called Nick Reed, who is not that Nick Reed. He was an Australian guy who, you know, I kind of fell in love with. He was an amazing man. And this was how I bumped into Frankenstein. We were doing it as part of the course and... I only knew up until this point the sloping monster with the green head and bolts in his neck until then. But that was when I first came across it. What about you? How did you come to Frankenstein?
It kind of got to the point where I decided it was time to read it. I guess, I mean, what kind of interested me about Frankenstein is that it was this, this myth. Like, I mean, before you read it, you knew Frankenstein, you knew... that Frankenstein, well, you knew about the monster, who was not actually Frankenstein.
Disclaimer. Spoiler.
And even if you hadn't even seen the movies, it was what you just knew about it. It's one of those kind of, like, Moby Dick or Dracula or those kind of books that become a story much bigger than itself. And so I thought it was about time that I actually read it. I hadn't studied it at university. It was probably about 10 years ago or so when I just decided it was time to read it. And at that same time, a friend of mine and Sean, my husband, and I, we decided that we would have a book club, particularly for reading Dickens. We decided it'd be like a Dickens support group, or kind of for reading classic novels, but because I was about to start reading Frankenstein, we made this our first book, so this was the first one that we read. What you find immediately when you read a book like Frankenstein, and actually Moby Dick, and not so much Dracula. I think Dracula is maybe a bit more like what you'd expect, but Frankenstein is nothing like what you'd expect. Yep. The story that you think you know bears a small resemblance to what you actually get. Yeah. It was so so much more involved, and also a lot more meandering. It wasn't the bam kind of archetypal story you think you're going to get.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Like, I remember, I remember finding a much more, I think that idea of meandering is a good one. And, like, even the structure of it, like, that framing narrative, you know, like, and that odd, you know, like, coming at it as a modern reader and feeling the artifice of that know, that sort of the letters, you know, and I think, yeah. So can you remember what you guys thought? Like, can you remember, like my sense of it was that it really felt like the best science fiction I'd been reading. Like, it really felt like, you know, like it felt like, I don't know, you know, like it felt like Neal Stephenson, or, you know, like that real thinking kind of science fiction. And feeling was another thing. I was really surprised how much I felt in this. And I guess that is part of the kind of romantic project, isn't it? But can you remember, did you feel gripped by it? That's another thing. I remember feeling quite gripped.
I don't quite remember. I think I remember being a bit bamboozled by it, but also kind of going with it, like, okay, this is what she's doing, and I'll kind of go with this. I was quite moved by it. Because you get this... Well, everybody's so much more articulate than you expect that they will be. And, I mean, including, and I guess especially, the monster. Mm. And you know, you do go along with them and you do really feel stuff. Well, I did anyway. Mm. I think I remember Sean thinking that it should have had a bit more of an edit.
Yeah.
But he's very interesting, you know, he's a very structural person. Mm, mm. Whereas I generally am like, okay, well, that's what she did, so this is what we have.
Because I always find that really interesting, because the way I was taught this book was that it was a flawed novel. Like, the way I was taught this book is that, you know how characters kind of show up, you're like, what? You know, like, there's a cousin, what? You know, like, and I was taught it as sort of a failed work, you know, like a failed work, which and what's interesting is a couple of we did this in our book group last year, and it was really great because Ingrid Horrocks was sort of saying that, you know, maybe that's not as true, you know, like you're reading, and you know, when I read it again this time, I was just like, actually, it's quite postmodern in that way, you know, like I don't know, you know, maybe I don't know what that means, what does that mean, but you know, it actually feels quite modern in that way, you know, like maybe it is slightly fragmented and you didn't need to know about that this character until now. But yes, I think that is one of the things that at the root of it is there is this odd desire to sort of, you know, almost downplay her good work.
Which I suppose could possibly be I've not read any of her other work, but apparently it's not that great. But then similarly, like Dracula, I think is possibly the only good thing Bram Stoker wrote either.
Yeah,
although I've not read anything else either. I find it quite strange in some ways. When something becomes classic, I it's not that I suspend judgment exactly, but I kind of think, well, it stuck around for a reason. I mean, we're still reading it for a reason.
Because it does seem to capture something, eh? Like, that's sort of, I mean, I'm always interested in the relationship between the myth, you know, like what you're talking about, you know, like, I don't know, Monster Mash, everything, you know, and the relationship between that and this, you know, and I mean, we were talking about Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein.
Oh, the other day. Yes, because that was the other thing that we did in this book club, was we'd read the book, we'd have a cup of tea and some scones, and we'd talk about the book, and we'd talk about things that we liked about the book, and and things we didn't like, and then we would watch some movies that were related to the book. And yeah, and for this book we watched Ken Russell's Gothic, which is awesome, but possibly terrible. But and also the Frankenstein, which you reminded me was Kenneth Branagh's fault and had Robert De Niro in it, and it's terrible.
It's really bad, eh? Like, and I think what's interesting about it is that it's worse in some ways than the kind of, you know, bolts and neck kind of Dracula, because to be earnest, you know?
Yeah, whereas, I mean, those Draculas, they do what they're doing. I'm not Dracula, those Frankensteins, they do what they're doing.
Yeah. Because that is what's quite interesting. Like, I think, you know, like, that kind of... that's what I think is so fragile in the book, is that if you try and interrogate or push at Victor Frankenstein's problem, you know, like this beautiful, I don't know, like his problem with death and his problem with life and, you know, the things that he's trying to solve through Frankenstein, if you push those, they become very, I don't know what the word is, it's done so perfectly in the book, but that movie in particular, you push it then and it just becomes sort of a parody of itself. Or so. You know what I mean? Like it just, that, I just remember that scene where he's like wandering around and kind of souped and, I don't know, it's meant to be like, you know, after birth and, you know, because, you know, I don't know, like it was just,
oh, I've obviously blocked that out. Yeah, it was too traumatic.
I think he was like stripped to the waist and kind of, yeah, it was.
I mainly just remember Robert De Niro kind of loping across country and being grumpy at people and emoting a lot. Yeah.
It's interesting, eh? Like, I mean, that's what's really interesting is that the book gets to sit outside the mainstream myth of it, eh? Like, I mean, yeah. Which is quite nice. Like, you know, it, you know, like it does feel like something separate to, you know, those other Frankensteins, which is quite nice.
And which is really strange because it was like the originator of all of those other things. But, but it's quite different.
And that whole idea of, you know, the thief's brain and, you know, like all that was in his heart, you know, like that sort of, there's extra, you know, there's extra sort of stuff being labelled onto that, you know, like pushed onto that myth as well, which is just so strange for me. It's so strange. And Gothic, I mean, I have such good memories of that movie. Did you enjoy it when you watched it?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I think I might have enjoyed it perhaps a bit more if I was slightly younger, and I think if I watched it now, because this was about 10 years ago, I don't know, I want to watch it again now.
Yeah, because when you talked about it, it made me want to watch it again as well.
I think and one thing I remember about it is I think it makes Mary Shelley look a bit more uptight than she actually was. Mary Shelley was pretty amazing. I mean, I guess maybe that's what Frankenstein really brought me to, is it made me really interested in who this person was who wrote it. And because, she had, I mean, she was someone of like a lot of principles, but they weren't principles that, they were at odds with the principles of the time. And I mean, she ran away with Percy Shelley. I think she was about 17 or something. Yeah, it was quite alarming to think how young she was.
Yeah, because that's what I was thinking about. Like, your poem, The Happiness of Mary Shelley, that was actually the first time I ever sort of came across you in a weird way.
Yeah, right.
You gave a reading of that poem. That's a poem for three voices, and I think, I can't remember where it was. I think it might have been at Thistle Inn.
Yeah, it was. The Black Mail Press launch.
Oh, that's right, and we'll link to it because it's on Blackmail Press. So that's a poem for three voices, and it was presented with three voices.
Yeah,
I think you and Sean.
And we got our friend Steve. That's to come right. Out with. He did the monster. I did Mary Shelley, and Sean was Victor Frankenstein.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because I remember being very very taken by that, because, you know, like sort of already being, you know, I love all that stuff, you know, like Gothic was just like my wet dream, you know, Byron's there and there's lightning and, you know, and I just remember seeing that poem and thinking, man, this is the coolest thing ever. And do you remember, did you write that sort of around that time when you were becoming interested in
Yeah, well, it was all around that time. I mean, what was also happening around that time is I was working on the poems that became My Iron Spine, and so there's a lot of biographical poems. And in fact, this poem was for a long time in that manuscript, and at the last minute I took it out, and I'm still not sure if it was the right decision, but I felt that section was going on too long. Like, this poem was a little bit different. There was already a poem about Mary Shelley in there. But I'd done a lot of reading about Mary Shelley. I'd read, I think, two gigantic biographies, and I'd been thinking about it quite a lot. I guess what it kind of was is a perhaps a biographical reading of the novel of Frankenstein, because I was really struck by some of the emotional similarities. Mm-hmm. although obviously it's totally different kind of story. It was in this kind of space of these biographical poems.
Can you talk a little bit more about those emotional similarities? Because that's the thing. Sure. I was struck again because I read it. I read the poem again this morning. Well, yesterday and this morning again. And yeah, I love that echo. You know, like I just it really and it rings true. You know, sort of revisiting the book for this, it rings so true. And I'm just I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about those emotional similarities?
Yeah, I'll give it a go. Yes. So Mary Shelley, she was the daughter of William Godwin. Is it William Godwin?
I think so.
And Mary Wollstonecraft. And so these were two kind of amazing people who were her parents. But her mother had died, I think, just after Mary was born. So she never knew her mother. And her father, she was really close to her father. But then when she started, I suppose, he was very liberal for his time initially. Mm. I mean, and Mary Wollstonecraft was, you know, she was like way ahead of her time. Yeah. But then when Mary Shelley, or Mary Godwin, as she was at the time, when she started thinking for herself, and she started, she got involved with Percy Shelley, and her father couldn't deal with these decisions that she was making, or, you know, that she wanted to be involved with this man who was, at that stage, actually still married, though he was separated. And he totally rejected her, and she was really hurt by that, because she, not only, of course, you know, rejected by your father, but also feeling that he was being a hypocrite to him, you know, he was being hypocritical. Mm. There was quite a lot of stuff about, I suppose, like the monster as kind of a child, and she not that she thought her children were monstrous or anything, but she had a lot of a lot of her children died, I think. She had quite a few children, but I think only one of them actually grew up to adulthood. And so there was, all of that, that emotional pain going on. I guess like Victor, Victor Frankenstein, she was sort of a loved and a child that a lot was expected of. She was sort of a wunderkind or something. And it didn't turn out quite so great for her. I read something when I was reading the Wikipedia article to remind myself about the novel yesterday. I came across a theory, though, that Victor Frankenstein was based on Percy Shelley. And apparently when he was at Oxford, he did do some experiments with electricity. There were some other things that it mentioned that were kind of similar as well, though I forget. But that was sort of a different reading, and also one that was of less interest to me, I guess, because I was interested in her.
Because that was the thing I was thinking about sort of at the time as well, you know, that weird stuff. Like I was reading some stuff the other day about how, you know, at the time they were trying to find the, what would you call it, like the essence of life. So there were all these weird experiments where they were electrifying dead arms and stuff like that, you know, like it was kind of rife at the time, you know, and you can totally see that this isn't going a huge distance from what was going on at the time.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, that's kind of fascinating, eh? Like it was quite contemporary. It was maybe like, I don't know, if people were writing science fiction about the Hadron Collider or something.
Totally. Because that's, and the other thing that I sort of, that's what I love about the book is like, one of my favorite things, this is so dumb because it's such a tiny part of the book, but one of my favorite things in the book, and one of the details that I think shows why I really like the science side of it, is that they explain why Victor makes the monster big. You know, he tries to find big hands and big arms because they're easier to sew together. You know what I mean? Like, it's right, easier to get the, yeah. And I just that kind of stuff just makes me think this is actually a book about science. Like, when I first read it, I didn't know that at the time, you know, people were looking at how things, sort of thing. You know, yeah. where does whether life...
it would be possible to reanimate
a
dead body. Yeah, what gives something life?
Yeah. And I just, so I think, I don't know, like, I like the way, that's what I really like about your poem is that, you know, like, this was how the book was taught to me. You know, the lecturer I had was sort of Freudian, and he saw this as a horror of childbirth. Like, he saw this as the dead children,
right,
and also as Percy Shelley, but, you know, his kind of, I don't know what you call it, like, controlling, and, you know, him being the sort of legitimate creator in the relationship, you know, all that.
Right.
It was right, quite tied up in all that. And I just think that's what I really like about your poem, because that echoes through. And I just think, and it was interesting because Janice Galloway, who wrote, I think she wrote an opera of Frankenstein.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which she's a really good musician as well. But she was talking about how no matter how fantastical a book gets, you need to understand the emotional truth of it. You know what I mean? Like, that thing about write what you know, write what you don't know. You know, like, you kind of do need to know the emotional truth about it. But, yeah, I don't know. It was interesting. So that poem, how do you... I'm just... Sorry, this is totally segueing to something else.
Yeah.
So that appears in Blackmail Press written, you know, and you... Have you recorded it as three voices or anything like that? No.
It'd be awesome. And that was its one and only performance that you saw.
Really? Oh, I'm glad I didn't miss it because it was fantastic. It worked so well. Because often you feel like this idea of a poem in voices is a bit of a trick, you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of... It's on paper, but, you know, it wouldn't translate. But it was just such a great performance.
Oh, cool.
And the way you did it was really cool because I think I remember all three of you sort of standing, and then you would sort of come forward and deliver a line.
We stepped forward when it was our turn.
Yeah, it was really cool. Yeah. And Iron Spine's got another Mary Shelley poem in it as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, much shorter. A much shorter poem, which is kind of, I guess, set much later in her life.
Yeah. I'm really interested in that as well, because I guess, you know, often, you know, I guess the what would you call it? Like, the dominant paradigm is that poetry is autobiographical. You know,
right.
I don't know if that, like, you guys have just done this amazing sort of conference on, you know, like, poetry and biography, you know, and I'm really interested. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that's an interesting kind of thing. I mean, because I agree. I think that poetry in general, unless you like label it clearly, people are going to assume that it's autobiographical and mostly true. But there is kind
dangerous.
Of, but I think there's some wriggle room as well, a sort of a liminal space, which is why I think it's a really interesting thing for biography. And obviously a lot of other people think so too, because we had quite a lot of interest in our conference about, it was called Truth or Beauty. Though, of course, we really came to Truth and Beauty. But, because it's a way of telling a story. You don't have to tell the whole story, but you're really going for some bits of meaning, I don't know, or emotional truths maybe, or... you're not telling the life as a story for the story's sake, but for what it means, maybe. Could mean. And making kind of connections. And so poetry can get away with a bit of perhaps not quite factual truth, or a little bit of making up, maybe.
Mm.
At least I think it can.
And there's that thing, isn't there, that kind of, I mean, it's probably cliche now, but that idea that... the lie is truth, you know, like, and that's what I think is so successful about the poem That's for Three Voices, is that there's an emotional truth in there, you know what I mean? Like, there's sort of like a truth, you know, like, I don't know, I hate that word truth because then it makes it sound like there's only one option. But what I love about what I think poetry can really bring to biography is that, like you say, it's not the whole life that we're talking about. It's one facet kind of imagined, you know, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of do a whole life, but it can only be very episodic because, I mean, even if it's a very long poem, you know, you're not going to... I mean, but of course with a biography, you can't fit everything, like a prose biography, no matter how big your prose biography is, you can't fit everything in either. I guess an episodic poetic biography, I guess, will highlight that more. Yeah, I forget where I was going with
that. That sounds good, though. No, I like it. So the conference was really successful, eh? Like, everyone I talked to was just in raptures with it.
Oh, it was a really lovely conference. It was, everybody was really excited about what we were going to be talking about, and it was a really supportive kind of conference. It was an interesting, because it was an academic conference, but it wasn't quite. I was... Along with me, it was organised by Anna Jackson, who teaches at Victoria University, and Angelina Spromer, who is a PhD student. So they're kind of the academic side, and I was the poetry side. And so we had academics and poets, and lots of academics who were also poets.
Yeah.
And it was coming at it from different kind of angles, I suppose. Yeah, and everyone was really excited. We had quite a lot of people from Australia, particularly Melbourne, and one or two from Sydney, and somebody even came from Perth, I think.
Whoa.
I know.
That's a long way away.
Yeah. and as well as having academic papers, we had readings, we had shorter readings, we had longer readings, and we had panel discussions, and a lot of discussion kind of... and break times as well. We kind of, I don't know, I felt like I got to know everybody during the conference. And yeah, it was reasonably informal as well. Anna said, oh, we'll introduce all the sessions. It'll be like it's in our lounge. So that was what we did. Yeah.
It really sounds, I mean, everyone I talked to was really excited. And that feels quite unique to sort of blend practice with criticism, you know, well, not criticism, but, you know, like, well, I suppose it is criticism. I guess that's what academics do, is they look at a work and see how, you know, sort of look at the mechanics of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there have been other things that have done, I suppose, slightly similar things, but not much that I've been to. The New Zealand Electronic Poetry Centre runs like a symposium every now and then, and I went to one about the long poem, and that was a bit like this. It had some readings and some academic papers.
And did you guys hit on biography? Because I was just thinking Anna's new book also, it's just such a great exercise in biography as well,
I mean, in her case, it's kind of sort of imaginary biography because it's about Clodia Metallia, ancient Roman woman, and so there are a few facts that are known about her, and and about Catullus, who these poems are in response to Catullus' poems that were about his lover, who he refers to as Lesbia, but who is very almost certainly this woman Clodia, so she kept with those facts where they were known, but she had to make a lot up. It was actually out of that. It was I'd read an earlier version of it. She kind of wanted to make sure that it made sense, so she let a few people read it, and after that I said, oh, we should do a reading of biographical poetry, because I mean, I'd written quite a lot, particularly in My Eye and Spine, but also there's a few in cinema that are also biographical. And she said, yes, we should, but it should be a symposium. So a reading grew into a symposium, which grew into a conference.
And was incredibly successful.
I think so. Yeah.
I think the format just seems so good. Like, especially, I was talking to a few people, and I think it is that interesting thing where academics kind of crossing over with poets is really interesting as well. Because did you study English at university?
What, I did.
You, yeah.
Yeah, I did English literature and also art history, but I carried on with English. I did masters in English.
Yeah.
One thing that was really interesting about the conference is it wasn't just the poets who were being, not non-academic, but were being kind of talking about poems emotionally, I suppose. I mean, the thing that I loved best about the conference was the way it was talking about poetry. Poetry was just taken seriously, you know. The value of poetry wasn't even questioned, as it is everywhere else in the world. And it was really academic and really intellectual, but it was also really personal and really emotional.
Mm.
So, yeah, all the, you know, people brought, when they were talking about their own or even other people's work, they brought their own stories into it. And yeah, we had a particularly emotional session, and also intellectual. I mean, I suppose it was like maybe the extreme of the intellectual and emotional, with a panel of Pacific women poets that Tulia Thompson had facilitated, and we had Leilani Tamu, Teresia, can't remember her other name, sorry Teresia, and Carlo Mila, and they were talking about their own poetry in the context of Pacific women's poetry, but also as a kind of as a personal political act. And yeah, it got quite emotional. There were quite a lot of tears from those poets, but also in the audience, but also a lot of laughing. It seemed to be this, I don't know, perfect place of I don't know, wholeness or something of all the different parts of yourself were validated. And I had this sort of moment in the last session where Amy Brown was talking about modern epic poetry. So not necessarily the most emotional thing, but it kind of was, because it was, yeah, she started talking about empathy kind of in an academic way, but also in a and you know how it works in a poem. But it was kind of like this moment of how important empathy is in literature, but in the world as well. I almost cried. It was kind of beautiful.
But I think that is, I was just thinking the other, because I was at a colloquium the day after that. It was like bloody, well, it was a week after that in Wellington. For a moment it was like yeah, just heaven, you know, just all these little safe little places to talk about these things. And it is a really, I do feel like we're at a really interesting sort of point in scholarship where for years, well, when I studied, because I haven't studied for 10 years in an English department, and or probably longer actually, no, 14, 15 years in an English department. And I do remember then, you know, there wasn't a lot of space to talk about emotions.
Yeah.
And it seems very odd, because when you, especially like even with the book that we're talking about, you know, with Frankenstein, you know, you can't read it. Like, you know, I always wondered that when I was writing essays, where do I put that in the essay? You know, when I talk about the structure of the language and this and that. But, you know, where do you put the empathy?
And whereas a book like, I mean, that I guess is what makes Frankenstein such a good book, really, is the empathy. It's like you feel stuff. Yeah, you feel everybody's anguish, and yeah,
which seems like a remarkable thing. Like, that's what I always think, that bit, and I will probably remember it wrong, but the bit where he leaves the house, he leaves the monster in the flat, and he leaves the house and sort of goes for a walk. That's my memory of it. Does that sound right? Yeah, anyway. So let's say that happens. Let's say in my version of Frankenstein, yep, that happens. But that idea where I suddenly got this feeling that this was like the anti murder story. You know, instead of killing something, he'd created something. And there was shame in that. And I just remember thinking, I just feeling really big and really, the tension was huge. And I was reading it then almost like a thriller or, you know, and he's walking the streets and I'm like, what a perfect authorial move to get him away from the problem. So in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what the fuck is he doing? What's the monster doing? And I just think, and I mean, what do you, and that's what I think we're so, I just think what sounded so good about the conference that you were doing was that there just seemed like there was room to put that back into, do you know what I mean? Like, to put that back in and to put the personal back in, which just seems kind of exciting.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, there was one of our keynote speakers, Jessica Wilkinson, who is from Melbourne. She was talking about, mainly she was talking about Susan Howe, who is a American poet who I'm not particularly familiar with, but who Jessica loves. And she was talking about some research that she'd been doing around her, and she wrote this paper that was about that research, but she put her own sort of story in it as well because it seemed kind of relevant to what she was doing, and she sent it to a journal and the journal rejected it and said, you've got too much of the personal in there. And so she wrote this reply kind of arguing about why it was really important, and the editor said, okay, you're right, and put it in. I don't know if this is quite true, but I wonder if because Jessica, rather than being like an English literature academic, she's a creative writing academic, though she does, I suppose, more traditional English literature research as well. But because I guess there's something about like the creative writing PhD perhaps, or I suppose, or maybe not so much the master's, but where you're having to work in both an academic space and a creative space, and it's kind of the crossover of those two things that is supposed to, I don't know, create magic or something, I don't know. And maybe that, I hadn't thought about this until just now, but maybe that crossover has something to do with maybe the growing acceptability of bringing the personal, your own creativity, into academic work. Just last night I launched a book that I published as Serif Press by a young poet, Nina Poles, and that book came out of a class, a modern poetry honours level course that Anna Jackson was running, and she makes them write poetry in the course, which is not something anyone did when I was doing English. And I think she partly just does it because she finds it really fun. But I think also, I mean, if you're writing poetry, maybe or trying to write poetry, gives you an understanding of the reading of poetry perhaps, or what a poet might be doing, or maybe it's just fun, I don't know.
I totally agree, because it was really interesting, because at the colloquium I was at, which was about the personal essay, there were some quite you know, there were academics coming from not the most touchy-feely kind of places, you know, and they were all talking about, you know, the catchword I took away from it was embodiment research, you know, which seems to be about being. And I think you're right. I wonder if, you know, like the fact that you can do, you know, like a music PhD now, where you make, you know, you can do composition, and then there's the creative writing ones, and then there's the, you know, the design ones and the architect, you know, like I wonder if people are starting to come aware of that, which is kind of exciting.
I think so. I think in society we need more thinking and more feeling, and the two things are not opposite, they go together. And I think
I totally agree. I think, you know, like just you know, hearing that, you know, just what you said about that idea of empathy, and you know, because I mean, I don't know, like, I mean, in the end, what I always feel like with the book is that I'm left with what I felt like, you know. Yet, yeah, I enjoy the intellectual rigor, you know, and I enjoy struggling with some, and, you know, like I enjoy that, especially with poetry, you know, that great thing where you're working quite hard sometimes to you know, piece things together.
Yeah.
And I think that, but that is about a feeling, you know, like, I mean, I think I'm trying to get a feeling out of it. It's such a weird thing. Hey, I wanted to talk a little bit about cinema. If that's okay, it's a bit of a segue, but it isn't really. I'm sitting here looking, your poem that was done for your recent presentation event in Dunedin, which is called Chris's Life as directed by Ken Russell. Yay, Ken! I am interested, because I often talk to you about films, you know, that's often where we end up, you know.
Yeah, because we have pretty similar tastes.
We have pretty similar tastes.
We like things that everyone else doesn't like.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what it was the End of the World one, wasn't it? Did you like that one, or did we have a fight about that one?
Oh, Melancholia.
Melancholia?
Oh, I love Melancholia.
Oh, good. Yeah, that was. Because I think often I do that. Like, I'm wandering around going, I liked this film. Who can I talk? Ah, Helen Rickman. It's one thing to read Frankenstein and write a poem about Mary Shelley. You know, that happens, you know, like, I mean, that has a long tradition. This cinema is a slightly different project. Like, I don't know. I love it so much. Can you talk a little bit about how it started?
It doesn't seem like such a different project to me in some ways.
Mm.
I think what poems like that come out of, like both maybe the one about Mary Shelley and the cinema poems, it's kind of because I'm not at university anymore and I don't have to write essays about things, which is actually quite a good thing. But I do love to, I don't know, analyze stuff and think about it a little bit and interpret it. And so a lot of these poems kind of came out of a sort of like a lazy interpretation of films. But then it got a bit more so. I mean, it started, actually, I think I can pinpoint when it started. I'd been to see a David Lynch film. I love David Lynch. And this was Inland Empire, which most people hate.
I love it. Oh, there we go, right.
I love it too. I think it's my favourite film. Although I've been a bit afraid to re-watch it, actually, because it's quite a hard-going film and it was quite long. Yep. But I felt like what I love about David Lynch, I mean, talking about emotion, like that's sort of how I watch his movies. Like, there's no point trying to understand them intellectually. Mm. I mean, you can if you want to, but he doesn't work that way. I think he understands them intellectually. He goes with them emotionally, and that's how I watch his films. They go with it emotionally, and you follow it emotionally, and you understand it emotionally, even if you can't articulate it. And I was sort of thinking about how I liked his film so much and how it would be really cool to write poetry that was like the equivalent of his films, which I don't think I have done, but it did get me starting to write about films. I wrote a poem about Inland Empire, which wasn't very good, and I then actually picked bits of it out and used them in other poems.
Yeah. I know that system. I can relate.
And so once I started thinking about, once I started writing these poems, I started thinking about film in different kinds of ways, and I wanted to approach films in, like, I didn't want all the poems to be the same. I wanted to kind of look at things in different sorts of ways. And then I started writing the poem you mentioned, Chris's Life as directed by Ken Russell. That was the first of a whole bunch of poems that are in cinema that are about different people's lives as if they were directed by a film director, which seemed like an interesting idea to me. Though that first one, that was prompted a lot by something Chris said. I mean, Chris did say, you know, if my life was directed by Ken Russell, there'd be a lot more explosions. Because we'd just been watching a film about Marla that Ken Russell directed, and it begins with I think it's a boathouse exploding or something, because actually Ken Russell's not really that known for explosions. He's more known for crazy stuff.
Because I think that's what was so exciting for me about this book, is that, you know, like, I've read other stuff which Oh, God, now this will just show me up as some idiot. But I've read other stuff which sort of, what's the word, kind of intersects with cinema. That's not the right word. Sort of responds to cinema. But it's often, these are all directors I love. You know, like, so it was just like, and like the sort of contemporaneous of it as well. You know, like you say, you know, like Inland Empire. And, you know, like it's just, it just feels so wonderful to read, you know, a poet that you like writing about movies that you like and directors that you like, and it just feels really fresh as well, especially and kind of ballsy as well. Like, yeah, I don't know why it feels brave, but it feels brave because these are names that I know why it feels brave. It feels brave because these are names that people have connotations to, you know what I mean? Like, to write a line like, if, you know, ever since Ken Russell started directing my life, it's been one explosion after another. You know, like, you're often dealing with subverting, you know what I mean? Like, what am I trying to say? Okay, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I just love it. I think everyone should read it. Tell me, when did you first start watching Ken Russell? Like,
oh, I think the first Ken Russell film I saw was Gothic when we after we watched Frankenstein. Yeah, Sean had been talking about Ken Russell before that, and yeah, and he was a bit of a fan, and so yeah, then we watched after that, because we did Dracula was the next book that we did in our book club after Frankenstein, and so Karen, who was the other member of the book club, it was a really little book club, though we also then later sometimes had Claire, but Karen decided that she would, as expanded reading for Dracula, she would read Lair of the White Worm, which apparently is a terrible book, and the movie, I still can't, when I first watched it at that stage, I thought it was hilarious and supposed to be hilarious, and that all the terrible acting was part of it, and that it was just supposed to be like that. I mean, what were people thinking, you know, thinking it was bad? Obviously it was brilliant. But then I watched it again not that long ago, and I was like, oh, actually, I think it is quite bad. I mean, it is supposed to be. Well, I wasn't sure how funny it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
I guess that's the thing with Ken Russell. You can't always tell if it's genius or terrible.
I think that's what my favourite thing about him is. Like, I remember seeing Lair of the White. I think I said this to you the other night. You know, like, when I saw Lair of the White Room, I was so earnest. And, you know, like, we were a family that I'd never been to an art film. I think the first film I saw, I think I was wagging school and I went and saw Drowning by Numbers. You know, this other, that's not Ken Russell. Who's that? That's, God. Anyway, I'll remember it later, which I always do. But, you know, which was this very, you know, earnest kind of thing. And then I saw Lair of the White Room and I was like, oh, right, this is another one of those films.
an art film.
And I remember sitting there and just being, oh, this is very deep. This is very deep. And then I watched it again and I was just like, oh, this is funny. You know, like, maybe this is funny. And I do love that. And I sort of see Lynch has that in a way as well, that weird thing where you're like, it doesn't wear its coolness to... heavily at all in Ken Russell's case, you know, like, it's just like, it just, and yeah, that I've always been interested in those things that do sit in that space where they could actually be real genius or they could be shit.
Yeah. And often the most brilliant things, I think, I mean, that people will either love or hate, I mean, like Melancholia.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I thought, I kind of knew when I went to see it, I was either going to hate it or I was going to find it transcendent. And I found it transcendent.
Mm.
But then, other people that I know watched it and found it hilarious.
Mm,
like, they thought it was really dumb and hilarious. And I was a bit hurt by that.
Yeah. I was exactly the same. Like, the thing that I remember about it most, which I thought was genius but other people found fault with it, was the fact that I never lost sight of the fact that I was in a cinema watching a movie. Like, I never kind of relaxed into it. I was always like, the performances did seem a little bit kind of like, pushing you out, but I loved
it. I suppose it's true. I did know that these were people who were acting, but then I still also was with it.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess what I kind of feel about things like that, and I think it's sort of inevitable, is that things that are really, really wonderful, or, well, I don't know, for something to be really wonderful or for people to really love it, other people inevitably have to hate it,
because
otherwise you're in this, like, middle, mediocre ground.
Yeah. That's a really good point, because, you know, that was something I was reading a few of the reviews of Frankenstein, you know, and I think, sorry, I was just thinking, it seems to sit in the same space as me, like these things where, you know, that lecturer said to us, you know, it's a failed novel, you know, this plot's clunky, and, you know, like he's a little bit too earnest and da 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 da. I was just thinking I think you're dead right, like, but I don't understand why that is, but I have definitely found it to be true.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it is to do with something to do with earnestness. I don't know. If you're earnest, someone's going to find it funny.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that will be me.
Yeah, often that will be me too. And I was thinking that about comedy as well. Like, I was just thinking about awkward as well. That's another thing that I really like, is awkward. And I realised that a lot of the laughs that a lot of the comedians that I like get, like I was just thinking about Maria Bamford this morning, is, you know, like a lot of the laughs are because people are embarrassed or awkward or, you know, like, and I love that laugh. I love that laugh that you get where you're just like, no, stop.
I kind of hate it. It's like physically painful.
It is. It's totally physically painful. And yeah, and I think maybe sometimes I think, because, I think, it's like often when I watch Ken Russell, I think that. I'm just like, oh my God, please stop. You know, please. But in the same way, I'm just loving it. It's wild. So, cinema is great. I absolutely love it. When you write a book like that, do you then put the covers on that? Like, do you still write about film now? I mean, that's a silly question.
Do I? I haven't been writing about film just lately, although actually I haven't been writing enough. But what I have been, I expect I probably will. I mean, I like to not stay in the same place. Mm. But what I'm working on at the moment, I'm saying that quite optimistically because I haven't really written much of it. But I mean, it's kind of almost going back to the book before. I'm working on something that's going to be kind of biographical again. But I want it to be different from the poems in My Iron Spine, because it's kind of part of a different project, I suppose. I'm sure I will write about films again, but maybe in a different sort of way.
There are also
poems. I mean, every book has the poems that came out at the last minute. And when I took The Happiness of Mary Shelley out of My Iron Spine, I'd kind of thought that perhaps there'll be a book that will fit into later that might be a bit more to do with fiction. Though I haven't written that book yet.
Because I was just thinking, I keep segueing all over the place, but I keep thinking about how, I'm wondering if your recent vacation to the wonders of, I totally enjoyed reading your Tumblr as you were travelling around the world, but I'm just thinking a lot Venice, of those places, yeah, Greece. Venice, Greece, it just Venetian. Feels absolutely, for me, kind of laden in a lot of that. And then you spoke in, was that in Geneva where you...
Oh, in Vienna.
Because
kind of bizarrely, but because of my biographical poems, my poetry is taught in the University of Vienna. Thanks to the internet, a lecturer came across my work and it fitted in with her course that she was running about fictional biographies, and she wanted to teach some poetry, and it kind of very serendipitous. So I got to do a reading over there.
Because all those places that you visited seem to me sort of like awe-striking kind of places, you know, like, I mean, and how does going away affect writing? I don't get to go anywhere, you see.
When I was away, that was my second trip to Europe, because once you go once, I don't know.
It's addictive.
Yeah. we probably won't go for a while, though, because you need to save some money. When I was traveling around Europe, I was very aware that it wasn't my real life. Like, it was wonderful and I loved it, and you're very in the moment, and I mean, you wander around being delighted all the time, especially in Venice. But I didn't have a lot of time for writing. I think I did actually, this time I did write two bits of poems, one in Venice and one in Santorini in Greece. But normally I don't do any writing at all because I'm just busy, like, looking at stuff. And I think anything that comes out of those trips, things need to settle for quite a while for me before I can really write about them, I think. Although I say that, but sometimes I write about things straight away. but I guess I don't know what it means. Also, I guess they're things that are not necessarily part of me. I mean, I, of course, would very much love Venice to be part of me. And I have actually started writing a little bit about Venice. But one thing that particularly after my previous trip, which was a year and a half before that, so about 2 years ago from now, because it was the first time I'd been to Europe where my aunt, well, the first time since I went when I was 18 months old, my parents told me, I don't remember any of it, doesn't count
but, sorry,
but so the first time that I was conscious, and I was really struck by, I guess when you go somewhere else you become very aware of your own culture because you're in a different one, and something that was air before, suddenly you can see it. So there were some things that I started thinking about that I think I will write about, and one of the things is about how in Europe, like, you're walking on corpses all the time. I mean, there's so, it made me really appreciate New Zealand's comparatively short history and how we haven't had enough time to do quite so many terrible things to each other. Of course, terrible things have happened in New Zealand as well, but I mean, the train station in Edinburgh is where the lock used to be, where their sewage went for a start, but also it was where they used to, you know, drown everybody as execution. Though they had to sink through the sewage first
before they drown.
And it's just kind of there, and they just live with this. And gosh, I felt like been needing to do kind of like, I don't know, sort of cleansing ceremonies all around the city. Yeah, we went up to this place, Carlton Hill, and there was like this sort of hump in the asphalt. I think it, like, was painted red or something. And we were like, what is that? Is that like a roundabout? But then I asked somebody later about it, and she said, oh, that's where they burned the witches. And it's like, yeah. Anyway, I'm not quite sure where I'm going there, but
no, but it's a huge, I think, I mean, I think that's the thing with travel, isn't it? It's weird because at the time, it's weird what stays with you. And I think, you know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do with these podcasts as well, with the books, is that, you know, like, that's why I know everyone freaks out when I ask them not to reread the books, because, you know, sometimes we're talking about books that people have read 10 years ago, 20 years ago. But I just think that, like, traveling, you know, and because I haven't had a life where I've traveled a lot, the books kind of change me in that way that sometimes traveling to a different country can do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I do feel with Frankenstein that I do there are things that it made me think about which changes a lot of how I look, which is kind of, I don't know where I'm going with that, but I do think, and I think you're right, like, you know, when I did get to go away, I think it was last year, I thought I was going to write every day and all that sort of thing, but it was just, it just came out corny. You know, everything was like, there are Americans everywhere. You know, like, we're in America. We just ate a really big Mexican meal. You know, and whereas when I come home, it's not till I, you know, something will sort of bubble to the surface. And I think that's the thing with the books, you know, that something does bubble to the surface.
It kind of composts. And yeah. I mean, like you said, not to reread Frankenstein, and I was a little bit terrified because it's been so long and I wasn't sure if I would misremember things or remember anything, and in a way it's sort of, it's all composted down, and some things have bubbled up or stayed in the front of my memory, but it's now become kind of a bit mythic again, like it was before I read it, except for it's a different myth now. And maybe that's what happens when you're writing. Like, I mean, this is, I guess, how I write poetry quite a lot, is I shove a lot of stuff in my brain. Like, if I'm going to be writing about something that's, like when I was writing about Mary Shelley, I read two biographies.
Mm.
I didn't take notes, I don't think. You just wait and see what comes up later. A lot of writing is like the results of composting, I suppose.
I totally think you're right. Like, I had this weird experience a couple of years ago where I rewatched My Own Private Idaho. Like, I hadn't seen it since it came out, and I rewatched it. And there's a scene in there where, Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix are beside a fire, and it becomes very apparent that both of them are, like, they're both sex workers and they both have sex with men. And one of them, it becomes very apparent, is doing it for circumstances and money, and the other is doing it because, you know, he loves men and he is in love with him. And, you know, it's all this complicated stuff. And it was really odd because I realized that is the story that I've been rewriting in my short story. You know, like, that's a story. Ah. That is a story that I've been rewriting for years and years and years, thinking it was my own. And realizing it had come from there. And it was the same when I read Wasp Factory. Like, I read Wasp Factory and I was like, oh my God, you know, like, this is what I'm writing, you know, this book, which I don't rate, you know, I don't talk about a lot, you know, like, I don't say, oh yeah, Wasp Factory. It is actually, that is what's bubbling up, you know, that narrative is what's bubbling up.
It's quite strange when you pick up things from places and you don't realize until later. In my Iron Spine, at the end there are poems where I hang out with women from history, and I just thought I just made up that idea. And then I was rereading some of Anna Jackson's stuff, and there's Anna Jackson hanging out with I think they're like women writers or something. And then I later read Paula Green, and Anna had got it from Paula Green. Yep. And so it's like it's become this tradition now of stealing.
I really like stealing. I think it becomes like, that's what I've really enjoyed about talking to you today, is that all the way through there are all these names of your friends that come in, and I just love, because I think this is, I don't know, like, I always love that idea of Russian craft, how everyone sat down and, you know, made things together or sung songs together. And I just feel like, in a way, sometimes we get that, you know, sometimes we get to, you know, kind of be inspired by each other without realizing it. And, you know, I just, and realizing it as well, you know.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I think it's really great. I love it. God bless it. Now, I think we've probably run out of time, but we should probably stop, obviously. I could talk to you all day. But yeah, I was just thinking that thing you were saying about what you remember. What really surprised me about Frankenstein was that what has stayed to me is that blinking ice, the ice, the whiteness, you know, like, which is odd because there's a lot of colour in it. But when I think of it, I just think of the monster running away. Oh, sorry, spoiler alert. But, you know, like, the monster on the ice, you know, I don't even know what that is. I guess it's the ice shelf.
Yeah.
And then the ice cave, that bit that takes place in the, I think it's an ice cave. In my head, it's an ice cave. But, you know, like, in the whiteness. What's your thing that you think about when
it's very dark. Yes. It's not the bright, it's the dark. And it's the maybe it's that image from the terrible Kenneth Branagh movie of Robert De Niro kind of shuffling around the countryside in the dark and burning people's and I guess it's of a kind of a desperation and regret, I guess, is my go-to image of Frankenstein.
I love that idea of regret associated with it. I think that's so good. So in the okay, now I'm going to ask you a question. This is putting you on the spot. You ready to be on the spot?
Okay.
Who would be your director of the movie version of Frankenstein? Like, you're making this up, you're the producer. Who would be your Victor Frankenstein, and who would be the monster?
Gosh.
It's hard, eh?
Gosh. Oh,
they can be alive or dead.
I'm tempted to make it a comedy.
Yeah. Do it.
I think, though, probably, I would probably want, I quite often watch movies and I go, oh, that's all right. But if David Lynch had done it.
Yeah.
So probably David Lynch.
Yeah, definitely.
Who would be my Victor Frankenstein?
They can be alive or dead actors. They don't have to be. We can reanimate them.
I was just thinking of Marlon Brando, but he'd probably do it too melodramatically.
But it'd be great. Oh my god, I want Marlon Brando. Oh my god, that'd be so good. What about the monster? Monster's hard. De Niro, I thought, would have been perfect. You would have thought not. That,
no, he was.
I'm terrible. Gonna blame Branagh.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that Kenneth Branagh version of Hamlet, which think would be great, but because it's got all these wonderful people in it, but all these wonderful people acting badly. Yeah. You're like, what? How could you get that person to act badly?
It's a gift. What about a woman for the monster?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, I don't know.
He's really tall.
Very tall, yeah. I don't know who I'd do for the monster. I can't get over that guy Tom Hardy is my favourite actor at the moment, but I think I'd have to Frankenstein him. I don't know.
Oh, he could be Victor. Yeah,
he could be Victor. Oh, I've got no idea for the monster.
Yeah. Well, maybe Brando could do the monster.
Yeah, maybe Brando could do the monster. We'll think about that. Hey, thank you so much, Helen.
Oh, thank you.
You're awesome. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.